Welcome to That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by Scientific Triathlon and hosted by me, Michael Eriksson. With me today is Jack Hutchins, back in the co-hosting chair. How are things going, Jack?
Hey, Michael, good to be back. All good on this end. I've been building up the training again after a little mid-season break. So not too much intensity for me. Just building the volume, and I try to keep the intensity out when I am just progressing the volume quite aggressively to not kind of muddy the waters too much. But it's nice to see some week-on-week progression quite quickly at this point. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty okay. I mean, we've been talking off air about a little niggle that I have that is a weird one, lower leg, not shin splints, but more muscular on the outside of the shin bone. So might be some anterior or lower leg compartment syndrome of the tibialis anterior, but I have physio tomorrow, so I hope I'll get it sorted then. But in the meantime, I'll be spending some good time on Ruby, especially for the shorter training windows, getting some good sort of short and sharp sessions done there and enjoying some of the... They've put some nice new courses on there as well. The Azores, so the Portuguese islands in the Atlantic, I've been exploring those on the bike. So that's been good. That's the great thing about doing three disciplines, isn't it? That you always have something else that you can do, or usually you do anyway.
Yeah, for sure. And the bike always transfers so well to the run, right? It's amazing, I find, how fit you can get for the run with some good bike work. But obviously, sorry to hear that the injury is still there, niggling. And I know you've got the race next weekend, so hopefully the physio gives you the green light and you can pull yourself together for that one.
I hope so. Yeah, it's big mountain race in Andorra. So let's see how that one goes. But I mean, I have to say about the bike. So I wasn't doing any biking for quite a long time, right? And I've now just put a rough estimate of my FTP into Training Peaks and into Ruby, and the number was quite low, and it did give me some motivation that after this weekend and this race, when I get back, probably I will try to fit in a little bit more biking and try to get up to some slightly better bike fitness and not do just the running. I think I'll be able to combine the two a little bit better and not do just running. But let's see. That's at least my hope, because I really do miss biking quite a lot. Even swimming, I miss a bit. I'm going to do some open water swimming this summer, I think. I'm not sure about going into the pool.
Yeah, there we go. I mean, injuries in amongst runners have been the birth of many a triathlete, right? I guess it's
myself included.
Yeah, I said that the bike translates nicely to the run, but you do have to have the time and the hours to be able to do the work on the bike, right? So if you don't, then the run training in itself is usually the most efficient way to get faster running. But yeah, it's a nice addition if you have that time.
Yeah. So about your volume base that you're building now, where are you at in terms of weekly hours, and what do you expect to be building to?
I did 28 hours last week, so and I won't build much more from that. For now, it's just adding a bit more intensity in. Over the next few weeks, as I said, I didn't have that long off, so it's not like I lost a ton of fitness. It's not like I'm coming back from a month of doing nothing. It was kind of just I had a baby, so it's kind of a couple of weeks of just doing a bit here and there when I could, with the baby being the priority, and then kind of adjusting to the new life. But yeah, my partner's been very, very supportive. So 28 hours, I was surprised to get in last week. And if all going well, then the progression can continue, and hopefully you can get some good performances in the next couple of months.
Yeah, no, you've done amazing with balancing all of that. And the baby's doing great, so that's great to see as well. Let's move on to today's main topic. So what we're going to discuss today is the 10 most important things for maximizing your performance on race day. So to clarify here for the listeners, this is things that you can do when you're actually out on the race course, or at least from very close to the starting line or the starting gun going off until you cross the finish line. What are the things that you can actually impact in that moment? It has nothing to do with the training that you do leading up to it. It's all about things that you do on race day. So do you want to start us off with your first item, Jack? I'm not sure if you or me have them in a particular order necessarily, but start us off with what you got.
Yeah, so I mean, we did these kind of together, right? But I am going to start off here with, I guess this is what I would consider to be the most important. I think you'd probably agree, but is pacing, right? So this for me, it's a big one. You can't win the race in the first half. Well, I mean, maybe you can, but I mean, the most important point of that phrase is to say that you can definitely lose the race by overcooking it in too early, basically. The harder you go, the more lactate you produce, the more carbohydrates you burn, and the more likely you are to blow up later, basically. So no matter how many carbs you take in, you can't out-eat that poor pacing. Obviously, I kind of the severity of the blow-up can be very different, but going out too hard or going out at the right level is a bit of an art form, and it is quite difficult to get right. For me, with my athletes, I like to get them to approach it by saying that the entire day is about trying to get to the last quarter of the run in a good enough form to be able to still run strong. It's not that that's going to be the fastest part of the run or part of the day, but you're still running strong at that point. And if you can have that in the back of your mind, then I think it just allows you to take every kind of minute of that race in with a little bit more control, basically. And I think unless you're pretty advanced, most triathletes, you should feel pretty well in control for almost all of the day. And if you're not, then again, most of the time, your technique and efficiency also drops. So there's a good argument to being in control for most of the day. There are some kind of nuances with this one, though. And you definitely have almost swim arms, bike legs, run legs. And by that, I mean that you can often push slightly harder in each discipline than if you were to do that discipline for the whole duration of the race, right? Once you get onto the bike, you're going to have fresh legs because you've not been using them. And when you start the run, you can also feel like you're using slightly different muscles, so you can push a little bit more. So I think you've got to take the pacing as a whole, which I'll get into, but you can also look at it a little bit specific to each discipline and kind of and treat them slightly differently. But basically, I guess you're going to go into some more specifics around RPE, but my approach would be you should feel controlled for the majority of the day. It should start to feel pretty hard, maybe towards that third quarter. And then that last quarter of the race is when things are really starting to kind of bite, I guess. What's your approach there?
I agree with that completely. And I think one helpful way to, I don't know if it's helpful, one interesting way to illustrate it is from a physics perspective, that when you run, at least for the vast majority of amateurs, the speeds are slow enough that you get sort of a linear return on investment of any increased effort that you're putting in. You're getting back in terms of increased speed. So that's a pretty... That's a starting point that we have. When you bike, that's not happening because the speed is so much faster that because of the aerodynamic drag and how it is not a linear relationship with the power that you're putting into the pedals, you have to an increase in power doesn't result in the equivalent increase in speed, right? You have you get much less speed out for the increased effort. So and the swim, even more so because you're moving through water, which is 800 times denser than air. So both the swim and the bike, for different reasons, on the bike, you're in the same medium as the run, you're passing through air, but the speed being so much higher, that's the reason why the bike behaves differently than the run from a physics perspective. And this is why, if you're not getting that sort of linear increase in speed on the swim and the bike from an increase in power, then it really behooves you to be able to push the run well. And people have known this for 40 years. You had a bike for show, run for dough. And sometimes it doesn't look like that's what's happening. If you look at like pro sports and or pro triathlon specifically, and you see people kind of sometimes winning the race on the bike, but it's not that often that it happens. And when it happens, it's still because they pace themselves well enough that they had a really a good enough run to still run well. You can't just overbike and then blow up and still win the race. That's never happening. Anytime somebody gets off on the bike, they still have to run well to win a big race. And here we should say as well that that's the example from the professional triathlete world, which is not the same as how an age grouper should pace a race. So yeah, I completely agree with you, and I just wanted to add that sort of physics perspective
on. Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And I guess even the amateur speeds are getting higher and higher, right? So it's becoming even more applicable. Everyone is so dialed, and yeah, maybe the powers aren't really increasing at the same rate as the speed, even though the training and everything's getting better and the level is rising across the board. But yeah, it's a really good point.
Yeah. So if I move into my first one, then like you said, it's about pacing to RPE. That doesn't mean that you don't use any other metrics. I do recommend, of course, using power and pace primarily, and heart rate also to some extent. I do recommend, depends on the athlete and the circumstances. It's in some cases, it's maybe something that is more of a collect the data. You don't need to use it so much. In other cases, it's more useful to use it. But yeah, pace, power on the bike, pace on the run. I strongly recommend having them available on the head unit on the bike and on your watch on the run. But I think that the primary metric to guide your intensity should be your RPE, because in your training and in your race plan, I don't think there's any single situation where you would set a single number, 250 watts is your race target, or 4 minutes per kilometer is your run pace target, because how can you possibly know exactly how you will feel on race day? You just can't, just like you can't in training. I think there's a lot of false precision, not just in training, but also in racing. And if you read articles about certain percentages of FTP that you should hold for different distances, that's all. Sometimes they're decent, those percentages you'll read. Sometimes I think they're off the mark, really. But you should set things up as ranges anyway in your pre-race plan, in the training that you're doing into a race. So when you do specific race-specific sessions, you're trying to, within the range, find, okay, where do you fall on most days? And that can be a good starting point for what you'll do on race day. But on race day, you might feel a lot better. You might have shed some fatigue, or you might feel worse because you had a hard swim and a hard bike, and now you're trying to run, and it's different than doing it in training. So the best way that you can actually maximize performance on a good day is to, yes, have your numbers available, but also really understand your body and how you feel, how close you are to being able to sustain that pain at that pace versus going over it so that you will blow up, or vice versa on a bad day, understanding that, okay, like I really need to dial things down, and then I can still have a decent race, maybe not the race that I was dreaming of, but still a decent race, and I can get the most out of myself on the day. So I think that's the main reason to use RPE. But then there's also a couple of other reasons, which is, first of all, equipment malfunctions happen when, whether it be the power meter doesn't connect, or even you're racing in a city with high buildings, so the satellite signals are a bit wonky, and you don't get good pace data for your run. So you want to be able to perform regardless of if something like that happens. And it, as a coach, I'm sure you see it with relative frequency. It happens. It's not something that is a small chance that will happen. It will happen to you if you race a fair few times. It will happen to you at some point if it hasn't already. And then the other reason to race mainly to RPE, or primarily to RPE, I should say, is that when things like environmental conditions change more than you were perhaps prepared for based on training. So you go from training in a temperate condition to racing in a pretty hot race and it might have become unexpectedly hot suddenly, then you want to still be able to perform well by pacing well. You need to let go of the power numbers that you train to and the pace numbers that you train to and raise the RPE. So the way to do that the best is to start right away in your next race, and then you get better at it every race that you do, basically.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's a reason why kind of best pros in the world still use RPE, right? And as in their race plans, it's not, you think that some of the guys who have the best teams and support and, coaches and physiologists, they're still using RPE for their race plans. I mean, I do like to use power ranges sometimes as well on the bike for different sections and race caps as well, sometimes for the first half of the run. But RPE for me as well is always that kind of guiding light, I guess.
Yeah. It's not to say that you cannot have any of those. I also have those and prescribe those, but power ranges, power caps. But at the end of the day, if an athlete comes back to me and they said that I didn't follow the power range because I really felt that this was the right thing, and then I'm not going to say that, well, that you did wrong. I mean, even if it ended up poorly, I'm going to say that, well, you did the right thing. You tried to raise the RPE, and on another day, it could have paid off. Regardless, yeah, you learned something from this experience, and next time you have a better chance of having it pay off.
Yeah, for sure. And maybe if someone's just gone to RPE and, walked 10 runs in a row, they could probably be a bit more strict. But
sure,
for most people, yeah. I'm on the same page there. So shall I go into my next point, which is a big one, another big one, carbohydrates and hydration. So first of all, I think it's important to kind of split these up. I know the precision guys used to use the term the levers, or the levers if you're American. So you kind of have your different, you got your carbohydrates on one lever and your hydration on another and your electrolytes on another, and you're able to kind of adjust those accordingly or have a plan for each of them rather than putting them all together where you don't have so much control. I think in a race scenario, you can fix dehydration. I've been in many races where I've been cramping towards the back end of the bike or the beginning of the run, and know that my hydration has not gone well on the bike usually. And I've been able to rally to get some fluid and electrolytes down me based on what I kind of know that I'm lacking. Usually I like to kind of overdo it on the electrolyte side. So then on the run, I can just take on water and still have, a lifetime best performance. I think that's not the case so much with carbohydrates, right? So once you're kind of lacking or having a bit of a bonk, you can't really come out of that and have a good performance. You can definitely recover from it to a certain extent, but I don't think it's the same. It to the same regard as a hydration, where you can kind of adjust and be a little bit more reactive. I mean, I think the most important thing is having a clear plan going in for as I said, all your levers, and this, whether you work with your coach or I know Precision have a very good kind of race planner on their website, which I think is worth looking at, and practicing it in training. And then really, for this one, the simple point is just stick to your plan. I'm not going to go into details of specifics of what you're taking because it varies so much for individuals. You talked about the conditions as well. Obviously, the heat, humidity has a big impact. The intensity, what you can tolerate. So you need to be practicing. You need to have a plan, and you need to be sticking to it. Obviously, I said there's some slight adjustments that can be made on the fly with the hydration, but ultimately that should be also factored into your plan as well. Have I missed anything there, Michael?
No, not at all. I think the example you gave with taking on more hydration when you feel cramps coming on and being able to work that out. I think there's another example that can happen, is that you start to feel the onset of some GI issues. And usually a solution for that is to just get more plain water on board. And you are often able to solve that because that might just be that you have had a little bit too much a relative concentration of usually carbohydrate. So too much carbohydrate in relation to your fluid intake. So that's the example of, yes, you need to have a specific plan. By and large, you should follow the plan, but then you need to learn to recognize those signals of cramp coming on, water and electrolytes, or GI issues coming on, just plain water, and you can make those adjustments on the fly. Or even things like, I'm starting to lose focus a bit. Have you ever had that situation where you're just suddenly realizing that there's a turn coming up on the bike and you weren't paying attention, that sort of thing, like you lose focus. That can also be an early sign of maybe needing to get more carbs on board to get some glucose into the brain. So there are all these signs that you can use to make tweaks to your plan in real time on race day, and this way help your race day performance. But this worked out nicely because around 20 minutes is when we usually do the precision fuel and hydration promotion, and we're around 21 minutes now. So go to precisionfuelandhydration.com and use the code TTS2026 to get 15% off your first order. Also, stay tuned to the podcast the next couple of weeks and even the social media, because we'll share some exciting news that Precision have coming up, but more on that probably within the next few weeks or so. Just a bit of a teaser there. So shall we move on to my second one?
Let's do it.
Okay, so this one is to maximize your speed on the bike. And there are a few ways that you, or things, a few factors in this. The number one by far is to stay in aero. Because how often do you see, especially in an Ironman, the second lap or the third lap, if it's a three-loop course or just a final sort of 60 to 80 kilometers, you start to see more and more people sitting up for longer and longer when they really shouldn't be on flat or flattish parts of the course. And so, part of that is maybe something that you can't fix on race day if you, for example, have a poor bike fit or your training is not up to it. But in many cases, it's maybe something that you do a bit in training without even thinking about it. You're starting to really want that change in position without actually needing it. So this is maybe an example where maybe that cognitive function is declining a bit and you need to get another gel on board. But just stay in aero when the speeds are such that you should. So maybe around 25 kilometers and above, kilometers an hour and above, that is around 16, 17 miles per hour and above, 16, I think. That around that speed, you really want to be staying in aero. And if it goes slower than that, then especially if it's on a climb, or then maybe it's fine to take a break from position and you're not losing too much. But for the most part, know when to stay in aero and stick to your plan there of actually staying in aero, especially late on in the race. And the second big one is knowing how to distribute your power over a course. And the main takeaway message there is that use more power, push more power when your speed is the slowest, and less power when the speed is the fastest. This has this is related to what we talked about before with how you're not getting a linear return in speed on what you're pushing in terms of power because of the aerodynamic drag and how that increases. So this means that, for example, going uphill, you push a bit more power. Going downhill, you push less power than your average. But even going into a strong headwind, you can push a bit more power because the speed is lower. Or when you really come to quite a slow speed, for example, going around a U-turn or coming up to the crest of a hill and your speed is quite slow, then when you're pushing power, you're spending all of that power goes mostly into acceleration rather than anything else. So, and that is something where you really get a lot of return on investment for the power that you're pushing. Again, with the caveat, of course, that at a certain point, if you take this to the extreme and you simulate this in a computer, you'll probably get an extremely variable power profile as the optimal for any given bike course, at least if it has some rolling hills, some turns, and that sort of thing. And you would be sprinting out of every corner and over every hill. So that's not the way to go, because you'll blow up at the end of the bike or at latest on the run. And you probably haven't trained in that way either. But basically, you need to learn how to find that balance between, yes, maximize your speed. That implies, by nature, a more variable power profile than just a complete flat power profile. But you need to find a balance where you can do that and still not blow your legs up, basically. And then over time, try to increase that ceiling, like how far you can go. And this is something that I think you see really good cyclists and triathlete cyclists. They're not necessarily pushing higher, so much higher average power, but they really spend it very wisely. I mean, Cam Wurf is probably the great example of this. I think that his power is not necessarily higher than many other pros, but he's just really good at knowing where to use it. And Sam Laidlow has a really high power or an Ironman, but he's also very good at knowing where to use it and push over those, knowing where to push, basically. The final one with maximizing your speed on the bike, I think, is to be self-sufficient. So you can minimize the slowdowns for aid stations. Basically, the fewer the times that you have to slow down and grab a bottle, the better. So get as much. Basically, try to get my preference would be to get all of the nutrition in your bottles and maybe in a bento box or whatever you have. And so you don't need to grab any of that. And the only thing that you might need, probably for a half distance, you don't need to grab anything, depending on how fast you are. If you go around a bit slower, then maybe you need to grab a bottle for a half distance, or if it's very fast or very hot, you might still need to grab a bottle of fluid, either water or electrolytes. But for the most part, you should be able to go around without slowing down much for aid stations. In an Ironman, of course, you will always need to grab some extra bottles for fluid. But my preference would still be to have all of the carbs on board already from the start of the bike, so that you don't need to stop and or slow down. And for goodness sake, don't stop for an aid station. Just know what you need and slow down and grab it if you need to. But that's a simple way to maximize speed on the bike, to not actually stop for the aid station and slow down as little as you can, as few times as you can over the course of a race.
Yeah, some really good points there. Maybe I would add the kind of technical riding as well, especially in some more like lapped courses that we're getting these days, and trying to stay smooth through the corners and limit the time on the brakes as well down some maybe more technical descents. Just try and stay relaxed. Obviously, it's if you don't have the experience, then it's easier said than done. But I think there's a lot to be said for just staying relaxed and not trying to force it, but at the same time, trying to be smooth, taking the right lines going in and out, and just thinking about where you are positioned on the road, using the whole lane in order to minimize the drop off in speed through those technical sections as well.
Yeah, great point.
So kind of in a similar vein, I have maximizing speed on the swim as the next point. And probably not quite as much to be gained as so on the bike, but still, I think people don't realize how much you can gain from being a kind of technically savvy swimmer. So I think the biggest one is probably the line that you're taking, and making sure that you're sighting regularly and taking basically the shortest route around the course. So you've probably all seen the videos, the bird's eye view, the drone shots of people in races, amateur athletes swimming all over the place. And, you know, you can add hundreds of meters over the course of an Ironman from doing that. So making sure you're sighting every 6 to 10 strokes or so, and trying to take the most direct line around the course there's a lot to be gained there. In addition, drafting also on the swim is super important. If you're in that position and there's people around you who are similar pace or slightly faster, and you're able to sit on the feet and sit in the group, you can save a lot of time. I would say even if perhaps it's a little bit easier than you would maybe be swimming on your own. It's usually a worthwhile investment just to sit on them for a bit and see how things go. Because the same on the bike, that increase in effort, it doesn't translate to speed in the same way that it does on the run. And so it's often better to be a little bit more efficient, and especially if you're gaining that advantage from drafting someone. That being said, and this kind of ties in with that first point of taking the shortest line, if you're overtaking people around boys especially, I think it's important to think about the timing of that. A lot of people will go around the outside on boys, and actually most people tend to leave quite a big gap and don't swim that close to the boys, so you can quite often slip up the inside. And if you're going side by side to next to someone into a boy, the person who's on the inside is going to basically automatically have a whole body length once you come out of that swim boy, swim can, whatever you want to call it. So don't be in that position where you're overtaking going into the boy. And if you are, then take the inside line, because most people do leave a gap there. The other couple of points on swim is the start. I think I can't overstate how much of a advantage it is to have a good start and be in a good position, especially on a mass start race. So a lot of local races and mass starts, a lot of the championship races, even for amateurs, start within your age group. And being able to get out in not the front, but in that kind of front group, you can really get dragged around to a quick swim, and a lot quicker swim. So it's very much worthwhile having a good start. So that's where you want to be checking the entry if it's a beach start, making sure that you're lined up in the right position, you know when to, how long to keep running for, what the kind of bottom is like, when to do some porpoises, when to start swimming. And then the same for the exit out or any Aussie exits. Being efficient in and out of those is really worthwhile. And I think even if it's just a deep water start, positioning on that as well is also really important. And I know we talked a lot about pacing, but I think it is worth burning a match at the beginning of the swim in order to get yourself into a good position. But yeah, I guess the take home message for that with the swim is that you don't have to be the fittest in order to kind of to be the fastest in some regards, and or at least to be in up there. And I know there's a lot of fast swimmers who are a lot better in the open water because of these kind of technical aspects rather than just pure pool swimming speed there.
I think that's one of the most exciting things about the swim, that there's so much race craft going into it. And the bike to some extent has that, but at least at an amateur level, you don't necessarily quite get to show that as much with in a non-drafting environment anyway. And by the way, when you said about drafting in the swim, I realized that I forgot to say that on the bike, legal drafting, obviously, 12 meters front wheel to front wheel, but you can definitely gain a lot from that in terms of maximizing speed on the bike. But yeah, but coming back to swimming, I think those are all really good points. And the one that I would add as well is to, if you have a dominant breathing side, then think about that in how you position yourself on the starting line. This could depend a bit on how the, you know, where you have the first turn and where that goes. But in most cases, I think that if for athletes that have a dominant breathing side, it's best that you're breathing towards where most of the field is rather than breathing away from that, because then you might actually, without realizing it, you kind of get removed from that, and it's harder to do things like drafting, at least if you're doing like from, you know, the drafting on somebody's hip. Of course, if you're a little bit in the middle, then it doesn't matter so much. But my preference was always or is to this day to start on the far left side, almost regardless of how what the race setup looks like, because I just feel so much more comfortable when I can overlook the entire field and breathing to the right, which is my dominant side.
Yeah, you do have to trust that the course is fair, though. I think I've seen some wild start lines where,
sure,
where one side is so much closer to the first can that it almost is. But yeah, no, I definitely think
that's true. You have to account for that. But if you have a, I think that, well, if you do the math on a straight beach line, that's the problem, right? That the beach line is rarely completely straight. But if you have a beach start, as an example, if it is straight, and then you have the first can is a few hundred meters out, then the actual amount of extra meters by staying right in front of it versus staying quite far to one side or the other, it's just barely a handful of meters. That is under the assumption that you have a straight beach line. So then, but then you do not have to start like right in front of it or very close to that area. Anything else on the swim, or should I take my next one?
Yeah, no, there's always more on the swim, but go for it.
Right, so my number three is to learn how to adjust your racing for the heat. And this is especially relevant now as we're heading into peak summer season of racing. The heat is going to be a factor in a lot of races, almost no matter where you are, or at least it could be a factor. And in some cases, you know that it will be a factor. If you're going to Kona, for example, heat will always be a factor. And now we're talking specifically about what you can do on race day, nothing like heat preparation or anything like that. So by far the biggest one is to adjust your pacing. So it definitely ties into that first point that you made. And I think on a really hot day, you probably should be slightly more conservative even than you think that you should be, especially if you don't have a lot of experience racing in the heat, because it can really, really have a big impact. And this is, racing in the heat is an example where I would recommend using RPE quite a bit and probably having some using heart rate quite a bit, as well as RPE, of course, but adding in heart rate as more of an important variable than I would in temperate conditions, and probably setting some heart rate caps that you don't want to exceed based on your heart rate zones. But still, at the end of the day, yeah, RPE is what I would use as the primary metric, but you need to adjust that, and it needs to feel really more comfortable than you think it should probably, especially, and the longer the race is, the more true that is. Then the other things that you can and should do racing in hot conditions is to adjust your fluid intake and your electrolyte intake, more of both of those, because you're going to lose more, so you need to replace more. If you've done some sweat testing, so just sweat rate testing, that is, how much sweat do you lose per, how many liters per hour do you lose, and you have a sort of a database of different temperatures and conditions, then you can draw on that a bit more. But otherwise, you can just extrapolate from whatever conditions you tested in and assume that, yeah, you're going to increase your sweat rate quite a bit in really hot conditions. Ice, especially ice ingestion, but also holding ice and putting ice in strategic places is good if available. Ingesting ice is probably the only one that's going to have an impact on core temperature, so that's going to be the most powerful one. But holding ice, that's more of a it's a bit debated, and I don't know that we have super clear evidence on how well that actually works to improve performance, but it definitely feels nice to hold ice or have it placed close to your skin, especially where you have a lot of blood vessels. So it is worth doing, because the ice is provided free at the aid stations if it is provided. And then finally, water dousing. So dousing yourself with water over the head and over your skin, everywhere really, to maximize the effect of evaporative cooling. I'll make a note to put in a link if I can remember. There was quite a recent meta-analysis about that actually showed from 26 studies or something that water dousing does have a positive impact on performance, even though it hasn't been shown to reduce core temperature, which is the hypothesized mechanism would of course be that you increase evaporative cooling and you decrease core temperature, and therefore you increase performance. We haven't necessarily been able to demonstrate that decreasing core temperature, but for sure the performance benefits. So water dousing is an important one as well. And I think most people do that kind of naturally in the heat, but if you don't, then that's worth taking as a tactic that you'll use in the heat.
Yeah, no. Really good points. I mean, it's easy to go hard on any kind of triathlon, really, especially long course, but even more so in the heat. So yeah, definitely echo what you said there. And in regards to the ice, I've always been advised to get the ice down the groin if your tri-suit allows on those femoral arteries. And it definitely helps.
Yeah, groins, that's where you have a lot of superficial blood vessels there, and holding them in your hands, and what else? Armpits, but that's a bit hard to really get them in there to stay there. So yeah, I think those are the most useful ones. Your next one.
So this one is about knowing the course and the transition flow. So we've all seen, I'm just trying to think, because there's been an example this year in the pro racing of guys taking a wrong turn. But there's always, every year, I'm sure, in a couple of high profile races, examples of professional athletes taking wrong turns and it completely ruining their day. So yes, it might be not quite the same when you're in amongst the middle of the bell curve and there's a lot more people around you. But I would say that you never want to blindly trust the marshal or the athletes in front of you, because people take wrong turns all the time, right? In the swim, it's also really important because it's so hard to see what's going on when you're low down in the water. So knowing which color buoys you keep on the left, which ones you keep on the right, how many, it shouldn't be neglected to make sure you know the course well. Also the aid stations, so that can be factored into your nutrition plan, or even if it's not factored into your nutrition plan, if you're dropping nutrition on the bike accidentally, if you have a bottle fly out or something, you said earlier that it's really important not to stop. So if that happens, you need to then know when is the next aid station, and so you don't have to stop, or you can make that decision that hopefully it's not worth stopping, and you know that you can get by until the next aid station. And also adding into this, rather than just looking at the swim bike run maps, I think looking at the transition flow. So almost all races will have a map of T1 or T2, right? And I think it's really important to know where you're coming in from the swim, where you have to go, where you're going out with the bike, and vice versa, and the same for T2 as well, because when you're on the river, especially out of the swim, it's your brain, as you said, is not working correctly. So just not having to think and check where you're going is definitely super valuable. Some races can be very confusing, honestly. So don't trust that it's going to be obvious, because I've taken wrong turns in races before. Thankfully, not too often, but
the best example of a triathlete taking the wrong turn is our friend and colleague James Teagle, who became really viral with that wrong turn, and then the very sportsmanlike athlete that passed him right there at the death of the race by him taking a wrong turn, stopping before the finish line to letting him pass. I'm sure most listeners have seen that, even if they didn't realize it was James who was involved in that. But I mean, I've also taken wrong turns. Not too often. I think only the one that comes to mind is once in Challenge. The first year I did Challenge Lisbon, I took a wrong turn there on the bike, and that one was a bit of a tricky one because it was on the freeway that you couldn't ride before the race. But that being said, there are definitely ways you can, even when you can't access the course, you can use things like Google Maps, Google Earth, those sorts of things to preview your course. And And nowadays you can even like for Ironman and challenge courses, you can ride most courses on Ruby. Shout out to Ruby. Check out the episode show notes for the link and the discount code TTS. And what else was I going to say? Oh, one thing that I think you should also know is penalty tents. If you do get a penalty, you want to know where the penalty tents are. Yeah. So yeah, I think then it's my turn, right, to take the next one. So that one is your mental performance, basically everything that goes into your mental game, your psychology on race day. There's quite a lot to that, really, and it depends on a lot of factors, from what type of race it is, what is your goal in the race, what is your individual sort of psychological profile, even from somebody who tends to maybe go like too hard or too easy. So that's it's a couple of episodes in itself, but just a few main points. I think the most common mistake that I see is letting previous setbacks in the race get to you and affect the rest of your race. So what I would, if there's only one thing that you take from this, is it's to stay present and don't ignore anything that happened before in the race, unless it's something that, okay, if you dropped a bottle, then you need to obviously resolve that and you need to start thinking about where to get your next, where to replace that nutrition. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about things like maybe you took a wrong turn on the swim and you lost a few minutes there. It's easy to kind of sulk and then you don't get the best out of yourself for the rest of the race from T1 until the end of the race. That's where you can decide that, no, I'm going to have the best rest of my race that I possibly can. So focus on the present and not on what already happened. Then, yeah, how do you do that? I mean, I think that if you only have external motivations, like a certain time that you're trying to beat or a position that you're trying to get or a Kona slot that you're chasing or something like that, then as soon as you lose that, then you might lose the chance to have your best race or have a great race from a certain point onwards. Let's say that you have a puncture on the bike, you get into a T2 and you're out of the hunt for Kona slots, which was your goal, your only goal, the only thing you wanted. Then how likely are you to have a good marathon in Ironman without a strong motivation to perform well? I would say quite unlikely, and I think here the longer the race, the more unlikely you are. So I think that you need to think about some process goals and some internal motivations. Like, for example, I think it's just remembering how good a feeling it is to cross the finish line and have given it your everything. Whether it was a good race or a bad race, I think that it always feels good to know that you've given it your everything, and you can remind yourself of that in the race. But everybody can have their own motivations, but I think having some kind of internal and process-driven motivation rather than only external ones is important. And the distance can have a role to play for sure, because if you have a longer, like an Ironman, or even a 71.3, then your mental strategy might be more about how to hold yourself back earlier in the race rather than how to really manage to redline, which it might be the mental strategy that you go with in a sprint distance race, for example. So I won't go into that in too much more detail, but the distance does matter. A couple of other things: segment the race into bite-sized chunks. So if you have looped courses, then that's always... That's quite helpful in that sense, at least, that you can just focus on one lap at a time. But even if you don't, focus on 1 mile at a time or one aid station to the next aid station on an Ironman marathon is a good strategy. And break things down into bite-sized chunks that feel more manageable, especially towards the end of the race. Those chunks get smaller and smaller. And self-talk is positive. There's lots of good research on that. Ideally, you want some more instructional self-talk maybe earlier on, especially in the swim, which is more technical in nature, but more motivational self-talk towards the end, in both on the bike, but especially on the run. And keep it specific and maybe keep it second or third person, because there's some research showing that to be more effective than first person. Focus on yourself more than you focus on what's happening around you. Not, of course, that you're not aware of what's happening around you, but what I'm talking about here is really focusing on you doing you performing, on you biking, you swimming, you running, more so than what everybody else is doing, because that's also something that has been shown to be more effective. for maximizing performance. In psychological terms, this is the difference. What we're talking about here is having an internal locus of control rather than external. And then the final one is to really be prepared to push to the maximum when performance matters. Mm-hmm. And of course, in a long race, this will be at the very end. It might be the final 8 kilometers of an Ironman, or it might be the final 10, 12 kilometers of a 7.3, or it might be the whole sprint distance race. But at some point, if you want your best performance, you're pushing your maximum. It might be slower, it might be faster, but you're pushing your maximum, right? Be prepared that it's going to hurt, but you can maintain that for longer than you think you can if you're motivated, if you haven't burned all your matches in training before as well. That's maybe an important one that you can't control on race day necessarily, but it's possible to, you think that I can't possibly hold this pace for another 5 minutes, but you really can if you just make yourself do it at the very end of a race.
There's some awesome points there. No, I don't have anything to add on your end. So I'll go into my last point here, which is transitions. And this one's quite simple. I've just got a few little tips here. But I mean, as you kind of said earlier about just keeping on moving, I think that's an important mindset to take through to transitions as well. It's not a break between the legs, right? And keep moving and try and optimize everything that you can to maintain that kind of forward momentum. There are lots of little things that you can do, and I'll give you some tips here, but at the same time, I think you got to be confident and comfortable doing them. So don't try and put your shoes on your bike if that's going to make you really anxious leading into the race, for example. But that is that. Yeah. Here. So a couple of things, the wetsuit, everyone's going to have to take that off. So you need to practice getting that off quickly. Put some kind of lubricant, in beneath the legs and around the ankles, so it kind of comes off nice and quickly. Make sure that you're able to reach your Velcro, and you know how to pull it off quickly. Pull the top half down as you're coming out of the water, and keep your hat and goggles on your head until you've done that, so your hands are free. Then your wetsuit's at your waist, then you can take your hat and goggles off, and then continue running to your bike. When you get to your bike, I take the helmet and number belt out of the bag. So when you get to your transition bag, this is considering the in the Ironman and for most races nowadays, long course, you have the bags. Take your helmet and number belt out of your bag and put your wetsuit and swim stuff in. And then a lot of people will then stand there putting their belt and helmet on at their transition bag. But you don't actually have to have your helmet on until you touch your bike. So that's a little hack there, is just put your helmet and number belt on whilst you're running to your bike. Some of these Ironman races, you've got another 300-400 meters to go before you get to your bike. So make use of that. Make sure that your helmet is on and done up before you touch your bike, though, because obviously that is a penalty. And then I said about having the shoes clipped onto the bike. Again, make sure you're comfortable doing that. Make sure you've practiced it. But the important thing, if you are doing this, is you mount your bike and then get up to speed before you worry too much about making sure your shoes are completely done up and your feet are in the right position. I like to slip my feet straight into my shoes as soon as I jump onto the bike, and then start pedaling. But some people can put their, it's a good option to just put your feet on top of your shoes, pedal, and then take it in turns to put each of your feet into your shoes whilst you're going. The important thing, I think, and what you see a lot of people do is they jump on, they put their feet either in or on top, and then they do a couple of pedal strokes, and then they start playing around with Velcro or getting their feet in, and they're really rolling along at an incredibly slow pace. Not only is it a kind of waste of speed, but it's also a bit sketchy, because when you're going that slow and you're looking down at your feet and you got one hand on your bars, you're weaving all over the road, you're probably going to cut someone else up. So get going, get up to speed, and then worry about putting your feet in. The caveat to that is, of course, the course. If you know that after 500 meters, you're going to hit an 8-kilometer climb or something, then you might want to be a little bit more quick about getting your feet in and make sure that they're done up ready to deal with the course that you have ahead of you. Yeah, same thing in the reverse when they're coming off is choose moments to get your feet out. I always wait for corners where you're going to be easing off, and then there's usually corners coming into T2. So when you have to get on the brakes anyway, go down, slip one foot out, and then slip the other foot out. I'd always rather do that earlier rather than later, so you're not coming into T2 with your feet still on the shoes. And I would say that getting the shoes off on the bike is easier than getting them on the bike. So I have athletes that they don't like doing the mount with the shoes on, but they will take their feet out of the shoes for T2. So I think you don't have to do all or nothing. You can just do one or the other. And getting them out whilst riding is easier than getting them in, I've found, or some of my athletes have found. Another quick tip is socks with the run shoes. Make sure that the socks are kind of opened and ready and in the shoe rather than just in a bunch at the bottom of the transition bag or you know, it needs just make everything as easy as possible. And you got your socks. So your socks are in the shoe, elastic laces ideally, and everything can slip on nice and quickly. Have I missed anything there from quick tips that you can think of, Michael?
You missed the biggest crime of T1, which is to wear your watch on top of your wetsuit sleeve.
I would say never watch until the run. That's
my, yeah.
that is a good one.
There obviously you don't need a watch until the run because you have your head unit on the bike and you shouldn't look at your watch while you're swimming because that's just not going to help you. But that being said, I actually like to wear it and then it's already on the run and I don't need to worry about putting it on the run. But obviously it's under the wetsuit. I haven't tested if I lose a lot of watts aero-wise, though, with or without the watch. So there is that to consider. You might be losing a watt or two. Potentially,
yeah, that could be the difference.
Now with the way that the front ends are designed, you're probably not losing anything there. So,
I just don't like to swim that. So I just feel like swimming with a watch is just additional weight on your arms, and it kind of messes with the neoprene of my wetsuit and the hand injury and everything. So I just actually on the watch though, a good tip is to. You start the activity and put it on auto pause in your T2 bag. So then when you pick up the watch, you don't have to worry about pressing the run button to find activity and start the activity. It's already going, you just run and it auto starts. If you want to later, you can crop the activity to get rid of the T2, right? If you have, you know, before the run course, or just bear that in mind that if you've had 400 meters to get to the start of the run, that you're going to have to run that extra 400 meters and you're going to finish the race at 21.5k, right, rather than 21.1k if it's a half or whatever. So it's considering that as well.
I think there's a couple of other things as well that come to mind with transitions. So one is depending on your wetsuit, you might benefit from cutting the legs a bit shorter. And also, so not only are you cutting your $500 to $1,000 or euro wetsuit, take the scissors to your Alpha Flies or Super Shoes while you're at it. I think, didn't you do it? I know that I did with my Alpha Flies because they were just too hard to get my feet in. And so you can cut them open a bit at the tongues to make it easier to slip your feet into them.
I did it with the Alpha Fly 2s,
Alpha Fly 2s.
Were the worst shoes I've ever worn, if I'm honest. So
they're really bad. They're really, really bad.
I don't need to do it with my the last couple of race shoes that I've had.
Yeah.
Thankfully. But that is a good tip if you need it.
And I think that's I don't think I have any. Oh yeah, one more thing actually is gearing on the bike. So make sure that you have it in the right gearing. If you have something like a hill coming out of transition, then, or if you have whether it's an uphill or a downhill, whatever it is, you need to have yeah, think about the gearing when you set up your transition area so that it's already in the right gear.
Yeah, good point.
All right, my final one is to understand your race dynamics. And your race dynamics means your race dynamics specific to the race you're doing and the athlete that you are and the goals that you have. For example, are you looking to complete a race or are you looking to really compete and be competitive, either in your age group or at the front end of the overall race, whether it's a pro field or an overall age group field? So those are all different scenarios and they have different dynamics. In a lot of bigger races, of course, you have rolling starts now, and that has a big impact. If you have a rolling start and you're not starting right towards the front in the first few kind of bunches of six athletes usually that go off at the same time, then your race is almost always going to be an individual time trial because that's going to be the fastest way for you to get from start to finish. But if you are looking to compete at the front end of the race, or even if it's at the front of your age group, but you might be a strong swimmer and or a strong biker, then you probably want to see yourself right towards the front of that rolling start. And that way you can benefit from the dynamics of drafting other fast swimmers and getting in the bike dynamics legally. And you can get some more speed out of your output, out of your effort, out of your input, I should say. So you have to consider those sorts of things. With the swimming there, to be very clear, I don't think that you should ever seed yourself in a corral that is not reflecting on your actual swimming ability. So if you know that your race that for your race plan you would benefit from being seeded farther to the front, you just have to train more and swim faster, and then you can start to seed yourself further to the front and benefit from those race dynamics, I think. So that is one of those scenarios where swimming can become a real focus. But yeah, then if that is you, if you have a strong bike, for example, then even if you don't have a strong swim, getting to the front end of where you can realistically be on the swim so that you at least minimize the amount of cyclists that might, you know, just block you off from going fast right from the start of the bike. And then if you have a more like a mass start or bigger weight starts, then of course their group dynamics will play a big role. And I find those races to be honestly the most fun races compared to rolling starts. And they're, like you said, burning a match early on can often benefit you if you get in a faster swimming group and a faster biking group. But you need to understand how many matches you have. That comes back to the question of pacing. So the more well-trained you are, the more matches you have that you can burn. But so I'm not giving any super clear answers, I guess, on this point. But if you're just trying to complete a race, for example, complete your first Ironman or something like that, then don't get involved in any of this. Treat it as an individual time trial. In many other cases, you also treat it more as an individual time trial mainly. But then in those cases where you have things like a mass start or you want to be relatively competitive towards the front end, not just of an age group, but of the race overall, then understanding those race dynamics and where your strengths and weaknesses come in and benefiting from the dynamics on the swim, on the bike, that's something that you need to think about and use to your advantage, basically.
Yeah, no, definitely agree with that. I think if people have the opportunity to go find some mass start races as well, they should, right? Because it's good fun. If you've not done one or not done many, then definitely would recommend.
Absolutely, yeah. And often the shorter distances have at least bigger wave starts. So that's something to look for. Maybe it's becoming increasingly rare with longer distances to have that. Maybe because they just have more participants. So it's harder to do that. Although they could still do waves, like big wave starts.
Well, yeah. So,
I think that's about it. Do you have anything else to add, Jack?
Just to finish, I wanted to mention about how all of these points are very important, but this is more about the reflection after the race. And a lot of people kind of put too much blame or emphasis on the race day execution or these points or even the taper when a race doesn't go their way. And it's important, I think, to also remember that the 3 or 4 months or years leading into race day still have the biggest impact, right, on your performance. And even though all of these points are really important and they can have a big impact, and this is more about maximizing your performance on race day rather than about making the performance, because the performance is made in the months and years leading in. That was my little point to finish there.
100%. I mean, even things like performing in the heat, you can, that a lot of it comes down to fitness. The fitter you are, the better you will do in the heat, even without any heat training. Even pacing, the fitter you are, the more matches you have to burn, the more you can get away with. What I described there with a more dynamic pacing on the bike to maximize speed, the fitter you are, the more you can do that. Fitness is it's the solution to everything, really, almost.
Yeah, I mean, an example would be, take Christian Blumenfeld, give him the hottest day ever, no water, no carbs, awful pacing, you know, bad execution of everything. He's still going to beat almost everyone, isn't he?
Yeah.
And that's I think an important thing to remember.
Yeah. All right, so let's wrap it up there. Hope that you enjoyed this episode. Show notes will be available as usual on scientifictriathlon.com. And while you're there, remember to check out the coaching services we offer and the ready-made training plans. And everything else, we have consultations, customized training plans as well, and the whole podcast archives, of course. So you can find episodes, you can categorize by swimming, biking, running, whatever suits your interests, science and physiology, for those of you interested in that side of things. And make sure that you subscribe to the podcast, rate it on whatever app you're using, and answer the poll for this episode. Actually, I might not put up a poll because I'll be actually on vacation when this episode goes out. But I will do it in when I get back a week or so later. So you can always come back to this episode. But yeah, you can send in comments, you can send in emails with feedback. We always appreciate all the feedback we're getting. And that's about it. Also support our sponsors. Now that's it. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.